Mail-in ballots go out very soon across Florida as Joe Biden campaigns in the state. Schools continue to deal with outbreaks of COVID-19. And it's a short list of candidates to take over JEA as their utility crews head to the panhandle after Hurricane Sally. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Join us. The number to call in is 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with the Leitner Museum's new executive director, David Bagnall. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
David Jones of First Coast News is on the line. David Jones, good morning to you.
Hey, good morning, Melissa.
Good to have you. Journalist and author Nikisha Williams with us once again. Hi, Nikisha.
Hey, Melissa.
And we're pleased to announce our new analyst, former mayor and UNF president, John Delaney. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thanks for asking me.
Good to have all of you on the show. So much to talk about this week, and we will go to everyone's calls in a moment. The number to join the roundtable, 549-2937. But first this hour, the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. The Times Union is reporting today that while new COVID-19 cases have seen a slight uptick in the past week, the rate of new reported deaths, unfortunately, has reached an all-time high for Northeast Florida. The last 8 days have seen the most reported deaths from the coronavirus, 94, of any 8-day period since the start of the pandemic. In a moment, we'll look at the way the pandemic is affecting local schools. That's coming up. But first, with early voting in our area set to kick off in just about a month, Florida elections officials have already received requests for nearly 4.28 million vote-by-mail ballots. Nearly 2 million ballots were requested by Democrats around the state and more than 1.3 million by Republicans. So as you can see, interest in the election is already high. We've had multiple visits already to Florida from President Trump, and we can certainly expect that again in the closing weeks of the campaign. After all, this is his official residence, too. And on Tuesday, for the first time in the campaign, former Vice President Joe Biden visited Florida. Now, a Monmouth University poll released Tuesday found Biden leading Trump here in the Sunshine State by 5 points. However, other polls show a much closer race here. We spoke this week with Biden's National Press Secretary, T.J. Ducklow. He cast the choice for Florida voters as a referendum on what he called the failed presidency of Donald Trump.
Look, we are 47 days from Election Day, and Floridians find themselves facing a pandemic that is spiraling out of control, you know, 13,000 deaths in Florida alone. And they're also looking at an economy in crisis. And it continues to get worse until we actually implement a national strategy to get the virus under control, which, you know, which is something this president has yet to do.
So we begin the roundtable with a look at Florida's importance in the presidential election, less than 50 days away now. Let us know who will get your vote and what are your thoughts about Florida. And it's 29 electoral votes. It's 549-2937. Emails to FirstCoastConnect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. And our Facebook page is open. John Delaney, I'd like to begin with you. This week, we also learned that billionaire Mike Bloomberg, who had a short-lived run for the presidency himself, says he'll spend $100 million in Florida to support Biden's campaign. That shows you, I think, the importance both campaigns are placing on Florida. It could be key to who wins this election. It probably will be, in fact.
Yeah, that's correct. Florida's almost always a major factor in whoever wins. I sort of feel like I've seen about $100 million worth of Joe Biden ads in the last,
right,
in the last few days. They're pretty ubiquitous, and I think his positive ads are particularly effective. And we're just going to see a lot more of it. I'm surprised at the ratio of Biden ads to Trump ads. It feels like it's about 10 to 1 for Biden. So each of them have their own strategies, apparently.
Right. We have heard, David Bauerlein, that the Trump campaign has been running short on cash. That may explain the discrepancy on the airwaves. That said, the Trump campaign has said repeatedly they have a lot of confidence in winning Florida. Let's talk about what the Jacksonville market means for these campaigns. If you could touch on that for a minute, David B. You know, this is a region that is typically Republican, although it started to trend a little more centrist in recent election cycles. Both campaigns are going to try to run up their numbers, their margins, as much as they can in Northeast Florida.
Well, no doubt. First of all, it's a statistically a dead heat. It's a battleground state. So the argument has always been that for a Democrat like Biden to win Florida, he'd like to keep the numbers close or even maybe eke out a victory in Duval County. And that would help to offset some of the advantages that Trump would have in the rural and suburban counties. So, yes, it'll be very we can expect to have activity in Duval County. I'm sure we'll see appearances by both of the candidates on the campaign trail. And it will be one of the most hotly contested areas of the state, without a doubt.
That's right. Nikesha Williams, this is a voter-rich area. You know, the I-4 corridor, Tampa and Orlando, gets a lot more national media attention. People tend to overlook that this is an area that the campaigns pay close attention to as well. What are your thoughts about how this will play out? There has been some speculation that the Biden-Harris campaign could take Duval County, but that could be offset by Trump and Pence winning all of the so-called collar counties, you know, the counties that surround Duval by large margins.
So I was actually looking at this to try to pitch a story for a national publication. And I spoke with Dr. Michael Bender over at UNF, who does their public policy polling, that, you know, the Democrats have a plus six advantage in Duval County, but the Republican turnout advantage is plus one. So I think as we begin to look at Florida, it's always important. It's the largest swing state. It's 29 electoral votes up for grabs. That it's going to come down to individual counties, as it always does. I think Duval will have a really big role to play in it. But, you know, Nassau, Baker, St. John's, Bradford, all those smaller counties around Duval will also play a role, because they begin to make up some of the advantage for the Republican Party. Just as you see, the I-4 corridor can go either way. South Florida typically leans more towards like a Northeast type of voting block. So I think it'll be very important. But I also want to say that, you know, as much as Florida is important, the Biden-Harris campaign in general could do what Obama did in 2012, and that's clinch the election with Ohio and other swing states where Florida had not even turned in their votes for like 3 days because we had all of those amendments, if you remember. So, I mean, it's up for grabs. It just means that, you know, people need to go out. They need to vote. They need to vote early or vote by mail. And if you're voting by mail, vote early by mail.
David Jones of First Coast News. Florida actually has a pretty good system of tabulating mail-in ballots, and there have already been millions of requests for those. They will start keeping a running tally of the early voting ballots the minute they start coming in. So we may get an answer out of Florida pretty early on election night, but that is not the case for several other swing states. And so elections experts have been asking media people like us to let the public know that election night could really just be what they call halftime. We may have to wait a period of days or even weeks to find out how the election turned out as mail-in ballots are tabulated, because there will be an unprecedented surge of those ballots due to the pandemic. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, and we see that on the local level too, more than 130,000 ballots going out here in Duval County just on that first drop, which is starting on the 24th. So we know that mail-in is going to be huge. And this election is just so different than what we're used to, both in the media and just on the societal level. We want to see the results as early as possible. You know, people have election, or at least used to have election night parties. And you know, what was it, in 2016, we were waiting up till early in the morning hours to get a sense of where that was going. This is going to be really different. And yeah, again, as you mentioned, it's just kind of reemphasizing that this is not your typical election in any way, shape, or form. And we just are going to have to be really, really patient, both when it comes to reporting on the results and just as Americans when it comes to expecting the results.
It's 549-2937 to join the roundtable. Cameron in St. Augustine. Hi, Cameron. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Sure.
I'm just, you know, I'm a 29-year-old voter that, you know, I voted probably four or five times now in my life, and it just baffles me how many people I've seen after the last 4 years of what Trump has done and put everyone through incredible to me how energized and how many people are still supporting him, which just blows my mind. And that's one of the comments I was going to say is I think Biden would do a lot better if he can find a way to energize the younger people. You know, I don't see Pence anywhere with 30 people standing out there, you know, with Biden signs like I do with Trump. And it's insane. You know, let's just look at the two different campaign methods here. We got one guy who's trying to ruin the Postal Service so that way he can literally win unfairly, and another guy who's trying to bring us together. So do we want a divisive president, or do we want someone who's going to bring us together? I guess that's my message, and go smoke Indy's barbecue. Have a good one, guys.
All right, Cameron, thank you. John Delaney, I think that speaks to the divisions that we see in this country. People are very far apart, and Florida will be close. You know, I mentioned the Monmouth University poll showing former VP Biden up 5 points. I think it's probably going to be much closer than that. And what's your reaction to that caller's perspective?
Yeah, there is. In the last century, there's sort of, in my mind, there's been four presidents that have had a cult-like following. President Obama, Ronald Reagan, John Kennedy, and Franklin Roosevelt. Obama in 2012 was down in the polls. I mean, the expectation was Romney was going to win. But that strong, passionate backing was worth a couple of points. Same thing happened with Trump against Hillary Clinton in 2016, that the polls all expected it to go the other way. Again, within the margin of error. But Harry Nearing is a former supervisor of elections in Jacksonville, and he used to say, what brings out one side brings out the other. I do think there's a strong anti-Trump passion, particularly among young people. The problem is, historically, young people simply don't come out at the same percentages as, say, people over 60 or 65. So I think you're right. It's going to be really close. I think it's going to be closer than the poll show. But there hasn't been a big narrowing. Usually about now you'd expect a little bit of a narrowing as people begin focusing on the campaign. Going to be fun. Always is.
Yeah. David Bauerlein, what about Florida's all-important senior vote? All through Trump's presidency, Florida seniors have really supported this president pretty strongly. But with the advent of the pandemic and the death toll from coronavirus, his support among that group has started to soften somewhat. Could that make the difference or not here in this state?
Well, we do have two seniors running for president. So there's Joe Biden and Donald Trump are both card-carrying AARP members. So to that extent, Biden can position himself as somebody on the area of public health, which is of great concern to seniors who are clearly the most vulnerable population of the COVID-19 virus. So that could be an advantage that Biden could have in terms of moving that piece of the electorate his way, especially in Florida. And I agree completely with what John said. It's going to be a much closer election than some of the polls show. The Florida Atlantic University had a really interesting poll where it was 49-46 Biden. But for the 5% who were undecided, most of them were leaning towards Donald Trump, which is strange. Usually when somebody's an incumbent and voters are decided about the incumbent, they break towards the challenger. So then when you max that out, then it's 50-50 if the undecideds end up going for Trump the way they're leaning. So it's going to be a razor-thin vote. To the point of the caller, yeah, I mean, Biden, if he's going to win, really has to mobilize more of the youth vote. That was a big part of the Obama coalition that was successful both times he ran for election.
The Latino vote in Florida will be key as well. Let's go to Helen in St. Augustine. Hello, Helen. Go ahead. Happy Friday.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for letting me speak my mind. I'm a former educator. I'm also Latina. And I will be voting for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but I think this is bigger than Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and it's even bigger than Donald Trump. Our country needs to change the narrative and end the disparity between races and ethnicities and wealth. We need to bring the country together, and if Joe Biden really wants to win, he needs to send a strong narrative and message of hope, because our country and our world is suffering so desperately. And the news and the tweets from Donald Trump, it really needs to become irrelevant. I'd love to see, I taught high school for years, and I'd love to see the adolescents rise up and those that are 18 exercise their right to vote. But we need a message of hope from whoever wins this presidency to help heal this nation, not just physically, but emotionally, and unify our country the way it was when I was growing up here. So I appreciate you letting me say my piece, but I will be voting Joe Biden all the way.
Thank you, Helen. Nikisha Williams, that will certainly be the Biden campaign's message, that we need to come together, and that under a Trump presidency, we're poorer, sicker, and weaker. Death toll of 200,000 from coronavirus, high unemployment from the pandemic, a divided, anxious country. That message is landing with a lot of voters, as we heard. But how do you see the Trump campaign countering that?
I don't know if they necessarily have to counter the Biden messaging. I mean, yes, they've been saying that, you know, Biden's for defunding the police, which he has not come out and said that he is for. But what makes Trump's messaging effective is that he continues to drill down and to appeal to his base. And those that like him don't think that we need to change. They think that he needs to go more to, as he said in his first campaign, make America great again. And so if he maintains his core supporters and they turn out and the Democrats do not, because that is what happened in 2016, it's not that the votes weren't there for Hillary Clinton. She won the popular vote. It's that enough people in enough states did not turn out to vote. More people sat home than turned out to vote. So if Trump continues to drill down on his current messaging and his supporters show out en masse and the Democrats don't, he wins re-election. It's just that simple. And I mean, some people don't think that the country needs to change. They may not say that they're racist, but if they can tolerate racism, then it is what it is. They may not say that they're sexist or that they are for extreme wealth inequities, but if they tolerate it, then they are voting with their compliance, with their non-standing up for something against that.
A listener emails the show, this election is obviously going to end up in court regardless of the outcome. Trump is making it clear he will not accept the results unless he wins. It is vital that election observers document any problems with voting so that there's evidence to support whatever court decision determines who will be president. David Jones, what about those fears among some voters?
They're very real. I mean, very real. And I think no matter what, we have to kind of accept as we get closer to this date that this is not going to be smooth. You know, there's a lot of efforts underway on the part of poll workers, on the part of election supervisors across the state, across the country, to try and do this historical election with in the middle of a global pandemic. I mean, we know it's not going to be smooth. We know there are going to be fights. And I think I just think it's going to be a point of after the election, all of us kind of as a society really coming together, hopefully accepting the results, although I think that that's probably a big ask, and moving forward from there. But yeah, I mean, it's just really, really a crazy time. You know, as a young person myself, to be watching all of this play out in this year where we're dealing with a crisis like we've never seen before, health-wise.
Right. John Delaney, what are your thoughts about the former DNI head, Dan Coats, the former director of national intelligence for the president, coming out this week and saying that there's so much anxiety and concern about this election and fears of actual unrest, violence, that there needs to be a bipartisan commission appointed to protect the integrity of this process so that Americans can feel confident that this process is legitimate?
Well, my gut is it's going to work out. I've done mail-in ballots since we were allowed to do it and have never really worried about it. And hopefully there's enough of a demarcation, at least in the Electoral College, that people are comfortable with the results. And I'm going to go back to something Nikisha said, though, that in American history, typically the sunnier candidate wins, the one with the more positive message, the more upbeat kind of a thing. And I've long said candidates in the middle of the race, they need to pivot a bit, not to change their message, but to provide a little bit of a new dimension. And right now, I don't know if Biden's positive message is necessarily getting through. I don't think there's anybody in the country that hasn't heard massively negative things about Trump. And the question is, are Americans fed up with the completely unnormal sort of a presidency that he has served? All the rules have been sort of thrown out. Millions of Republicans did not vote for him in the last election, and he still managed to pull it out, albeit it was so close. You had really a 40,000, 45,000 people lines totally in Wisconsin, Michigan, now. So we'll see where it goes. I think, you know, the 2000 election was about as disruptive as you could get, and people in the end accepted the results. And I think it's going to work out this time, too.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Roundtable with John Delaney, Nakeisha Williams, David Bauerlein, David Jones, and yours truly. It's 549-2937. We're going to shift gears now and talk about schools and COVID. Now, new state data released this week shows that more than 12,000 Florida kids age 17 and under have been infected with COVID-19 since schools first began reopening their doors. This has prompted groups representing both teachers and parents to demand more transparency. Now, all of this is unfolding as more local students are set to return to brick-and-mortar class 5 days a week in Duval County. David Jones of First Coast News, you have some numbers you can share about this, yes?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I was saying this yesterday in my story. There have been so many difficult choices made, right? I mean, there's been difficult choices made by school administrators, by teachers, by parents. And we see that kind of play out. We got the most recent numbers from DCPS, from Duval County Schools, on the number of teachers who have resigned or retired. We saw that the number who have retired actually almost doubled from last year. So last year was 22. Between August 1st and September 3rd, that same time period this year, was 40 teachers who have retired. Resignations also went up from 48 last year to 59 this year, you know, which to, you know, on the outside might seem like a small number, but when you're talking about a state that has dealt with a teacher shortage, that definitely is not helping. So it's just been a lot of hard choices and a lot of kind of walking on eggshells, it seems like, you know, both for teachers and for students, just kind of waiting to see how all this plays out. Because as you just mentioned, Melissa, not all Duval County students are back in school yet. We know 7th and 8th grade going back next Monday and then high schoolers returning on the 28th. So there's still some time to wait before we really see the impact on the number of cases across the state. But, you know, we know that ultimately when you're talking about a younger population, it's less about them being hospitalized or dying, and it's more about them possibly spreading the virus to grandparents, you know, parents, things like that. So it's a really a tough time, and I guess my heart just, you know, goes out to teachers and to students and parents right now, because it's not an easy path to navigate.
That's right. I would encourage everyone to read a piece on our website at wjct.org. This show's producer, Heather Schatz, had to quarantine her son from his school in St. Johns County because a child in his class in middle school has tested positive for COVID. And she has shared her experience with that. David Bauerlein, your organization, the Times Union, has pushed for more transparency around these school dashboard cases. Pediatric cases since August 10th are up 20%. So are pediatric hospitalizations. All but 9 Florida counties have a pediatric positivity rate above 10%. However, the Florida chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics says that the maximum rate should be 5% before reopening classrooms. That speaks to the controversy around sending children back to school. Certainly, parents want their kids back in school. It's better that way for their academic environment, but the rate of disease is still too high, according to doctors, to safely do that.
Yeah, well, first of all, the Duval County Public Schools does do the daily dashboard. So that's something that's a real benefit for parents. They can look at what the trends are. They can also look at what the schools are so they can know how many cases are among students and teachers. So it has been good in that respect. The information is power. People are able to make their decisions in that regard. You know, and as far as the figures, I think David is right that we don't really know the full impact until all the schools of all grade levels are in action. From my perspective, I don't see that the number of cases is alarming simply because you're in the middle of a pandemic and there's going to be some infections whether children are in school or not. So I'm not sure really what the benchmark would be. Certainly that pediatric report does have one benchmark that it's too high. Overall, the cases are going down. There's a lower positivity rate in Duval County. I still think that the schools are just a mirror of the community. And if there's a high positivity rate, outside the schools. That's going to be the case in the schools. So it's a positive trend, I think, that the positivity rate overall is going down in the county, because I think that's going to be positive as well for schools to be able to have not as much of a risk as they otherwise would for the virus spreading.
That's right. A listener tweets the show, "This is frightening. It's a tough time for parents, teachers, and students. I almost wish we'd scale back focus to just 2 to 3 subjects to make it easier." Nikisha, my kids would love that. They'd love that. What about the concern? You know, when you study the flu pandemic of 100 years ago, there were basically 3 big waves. And epidemiologists have warned that this fall and winter, we may see another huge, hopefully not, but another big wave of this disease as schools continue with their year. There's more reopening of businesses, bars, and so forth. The fear is that we could all shut down again, in other words, if the wave grows large enough and we get further into the soup of that.
I'm honestly just waiting for that to happen. I sent my son back to school. He's in kindergarten. I've never met the teacher. I don't know the layout of the school. All I know is how to get into the parent pickup and drop off line. I've gotten a COVID call from the school twice that someone in the school, I don't know if it's a parent, a teacher, a student, a staff member, has come in contact with or tested positive for COVID, but I have never gotten a contact tracing from the Department of Health to say that it's affected my child. So, I mean, I'm sending him back to school, knowing the risk, knowing the positivity rate, and confident in his ability to keep his mask on, because that's what I've instilled in him at home. And, I mean, we're about to hit flu season next month. 50,000 people die during flu season every year. So flu season is already deadly, and then we're going to have a global pandemic, which has already been proven to be extremely deadly, colliding. And just with the lackadaisical way that our country, our government has gone about trying to rein in this pandemic at a federal level, I believe it's only going to lead to another shutdown come January, February. It's only going to lead to another round of mass lockdowns and homeschooling and all the things that we were so uncomfortable with in March, April, May, and June, but that we refused to mitigate by doing what we were supposed to do, by wearing masks all the time, staying 6 feet apart, not gathering in masks, not going to the beaches, not going to the bars and the clubs and everything else that was open. There is a way to get through this, but we just are not doing it as a country, as a county, as a state, as a community. And it's just like, we don't care. It's like, yeah, it's a pandemic, but it's not affecting me. I'm gonna send the kid to school. I have to go to work. And it's going to be what it is. And so at this point, like Michelle Obama said during the DNC, it is what it is.
John Delaney, what about that? What are your thoughts as well, if I could ask you, about how colleges and universities are handling this situation? Because there have been outbreaks of COVID at Florida State, other campuses around the country.
Well, when you put people together, you're going to have an increase in the spread of the virus. I mean, there's just no way around that. And I think the country has sort of decided we can't just shut down schools and colleges. We need to do our best to have the masks and the distancing and the cleaning. And I'll tell you who I think really is phenomenally unsung heroes, and we ought to be doing monuments for them, is teachers. I mean, they've got twice as much work. They're worried about their own risks. A lot of teachers have their own health risks that could really be attacked if they got infected with COVID. What they're doing is just simply heroic, and I see – you know, the pictures of the teachers going to meet kids in their driveways and things like this, the love and affection they have to teaching for children is just paramount and obvious now. And I think they really need a huge reward and a huge compliment. I don't think they're getting the attention they should.
Yeah, thanks for that. We are hearing this morning that the Florida Education Association will hold a news conference. Actually, it's starting right now, to give their perspective on what they think state officials should be doing to address what they call the chaos and instability in Florida's schools. I'm quoting here, "A month into the academic year, we hear daily reports of learning conditions that shortchange students and leave teachers in tears, of student-teacher ratios that undermine quality education, and of fear that conditions will grow worse for students and educators if action is not taken quickly," the release says. Let me take another call. It's Vicki in St. Augustine. Vicki, good morning.
Hey, good morning. I I have an 8-year-old child, and I'm lucky enough to be able to work from home and keep him home. And under no circumstances would I send him to school until we have a reliable, safe vaccine. But I am completely appalled by the cavalier attitude that any child, any teacher, any support staff contracting COVID due to irresponsibility is okay. That any number is fine. It's not fine. We're at a time where we need 100% transparency. No information should be withheld from parents. My heart breaks for any parent who has to send their kid to school because they have to work and they are not given all of the information to make a responsible, clear call as to what they should do with their child. And having family members and friends who work in the school system right now in St. John's County, I can tell you that every day I speak with somebody in my life who is scared that they're going to get it. They have come to the realization that they're going to get it. And the attitude within the school from other teachers and from the administrative staff that we just have to accept it. And there's really not much we can do. If a kid wants to not wear their mask, that's okay. I can't believe this is happening in America in 2020. I am shocked. I'm shocked.
Vicki, thank you. Here is an email from Chip. He writes, my wife is working as a rapid response nurse in the school system for COVID cases. It is evident to her that the program delays reporting of COVID incidence data to the health department. I have no trust that the low numbers being reported by the state are accurate. My concern is that the underreporting and delayed reporting will unfairly validate the decision to force the reopening of schools. The consequence of this delayed reporting may only become evident with a further increase in infections and deaths. Okay, David Jones, this is such heavy stuff. And you hear the outrage and the anxiety in the voices of callers like Vicki. Parents, teachers, and kids have so much anxiety right now, and it really is just an impossible situation for all of us. It's so difficult. What are you hearing when you report on this?
I mean, the sentiment that Vicki just expressed is echoed, and it's not just echoed by parents, it's echoed by teachers that I speak with as well, and you know, it's a perfect way to describe it. It's an impossible situation, right? Because having 5 days a week in-person learning is obviously very important for a lot of people. I mean, you've got people, I think back to when I was growing up, I would not have been able to stay home. If my parents worked and needed to be out of the house, you know, in that same kind of sense now, there are a lot of people who are grateful for the 5-day week in-person learning. And there are also a lot of people like Vicki who don't feel safe sending their children in. And I think it's kind of seemed like we're all looking at schools as guinea pigs as we look toward a greater societal reopening and then trying to recover from this virus. We're looking toward the numbers in school districts, of teachers, of students who contract this. And to me, it's kind of wild how much teachers have had to go through in recent years and how much is being put on their plate right now. So it's an impossible situation. There's no easy answer. And you're reading from that FEA press release too. They have really been fighting this on the state level and continue to fight it along with local unions, which was that mandate that came down from Tallahassee that all school districts have to offer 5-day a week in-person learning. Duval got an exception to that because the RNC was going to be coming to Jacksonville. And so they were kind of able to do this hybrid model, which Superintendent Green and district leadership have been praising. The hybrid model basically being middle schoolers and high schoolers able to stay home a couple days a week, go to class a couple days a week, that kind of gives some downtime to clean the building and things like that. Well, they were going back and forth with the state on that. They wanted to extend, you know, how long they could do the hybrid model in Duval County, and the state basically told them by the 28th, everyone's back in class. You know, so it's a tough position for district leadership to be in. And I, again, I just, John said it best. Teachers are really have been the unsung heroes
they have.
Here, and we just got to give them all the praise.
We need to give props to all frontline workers, and we're sad to report the Clay County Sheriff's Office this week lost Sergeant Eric Twisdale. His death is being treated as a line of duty death related to COVID-19. His fellow officers say he was courageous and had a huge heart. And by the way, the pandemic could mean lights out at the Jacksonville Zoo and Gardens unless the public steps up. They need to raise $250,000 right away. The money will go to operating costs, including the care of their animals and plants. Remember, it is the zoo and gardens. You can text ZOO to 560-5600 or donate online at jacksonvillezoo.org. Finally, this week, JEA has narrowed it down to a short list for its search for a new CEO. David Bauerlein, bring us up to date on this, if you could.
Well, they're down to six finalists, and they come from utilities across the country. It's going to be interesting that we know at this point that, unlike the past, whoever is the next CEO at JEA will not be somebody who has worked previously at JEA. So there was a model at one point that they hired from within and then promoted from within. That kind of changed when Aaron Zahn went from the board to the interim CEO to the CEO position and then was fired in January. Now it's going to be completely from outside JEA that the next CEO will come and probably will bring in their own people as well when they're hired. We should have an answer in October, thereabouts, on who the next CEO will be.
And, okay. And meanwhile, they are sending crews to the panhandle today to assist with Hurricane Sally recovery. John Delaney, all this as a federal grand jury investigation continues into the failed attempt to privatize the utility.
You've got a completely independent board. Several of them are friends of mine now, and they say the financial condition of the JEA is terrific. And as to the grand jury investigation, frankly, I expect indictments. I think the bonus plan was an attempted fraud and an attempted theft, and that nightmare is going to continue for a while because the feds don't operate quickly. It could be some time before we see what's going on there.
So you do think indictments will come down then in this matter?
Yeah, I actually think it fits better under state law. Under state law, a theft is if you attempt to get somebody to part with their money by misrepresentation or fraud. And clearly the board was misinformed, directly misinformed by senior management about how much those bonus payments could have been. In the bonus plan, there's some language that also, it's pretty clear they were aware that these payouts could be huge, because it would have violated a specific provision of the IRS code. They were so big. And misrepresenting that to the board, I think that alone is going to be enough. And we know some documents were doctored. The Times Union has done a phenomenal job exposing that. I'd be stunned. I would be absolutely stunned if somebody in management at the former management of the JEA is not indicted.
We'll continue to follow it, but I want to thank all of you so much for sharing some of your Friday with us. Thanks, Roundtable. John Delaney, Nakisha Williams, David Jones, and David Bauerlein. Always great to hear your voices, and I look forward to the day when you're here in person. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Nice job. Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Up next, a conversation with the new leader at the Leitner Museum in St. Augustine. But first, here's how you can support this public radio station.
You can give us a call at 353-9528. Thank you, Melissa. Great program as usual. We'll get right back to it in about 4.5 minutes. But first, give us a call at 353-9528 and show your support for this program and all the other news programs. I'm David Luckin here with Michelle Corum. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, David. This is one of my favorite shows in the morning, even after I'm off the air. I love to listen to this show because it's got call-ins from people who live in the community who are also weighing in and giving their own reports and stories about the issues that affect all of us. So if this is a program that you like to hear as well, then give us a call right now. We're asking that, just taking a minute. We'll go back to the show in a minute. We will ask for your support at 904-353-9528. People are there. They can take your pledge of support, your information, and of course we keep everything real close to the vest as far as all your valuable information, but just make a pledge of support. Any amount will help. And again, the number is 904-353-9528. match.
And you know what the best part is, Michelle?
What?
I'm going to interrupt you for one second. We're going to match everyone who calls. We're going to match it. We're going to double their 100 to 200, their 5 to 10, their 500 to 1,000, whatever you call in with today. We have a generous First Coast Society member who said...
That would be Susan?
Susan, and she said, we'll match everybody today. So let's
get you in.
You know, let's say 5,000 will be 10,000, 1,000 will be 2. Whatever you send us and whatever we make today is going to be matched. So that is so important. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's a great incentive. And if you haven't already given to the drive, we do greatly, if you have already, we greatly appreciate it. But otherwise, now's the perfect opportunity to renew your support and have your gift doubled. But we also want to thank those sustainers and folks who give regularly each month. If you give $20 every month, I believe that's a sustainer, that if you're all year round, $20.
You can get in, I think, as little as five.
Oh, as five? Okay.
And 10 is the most popular because that's just 120. But some folks have upped it to 15 this year, and they've just added a $5 bill to that each month, and that's a nice thing to do. If you're a sustainer, you could just do a one-time gift, and that will be doubled today. Unfortunately, your whole sustainer thing won't be, but anything you call in today will be doubled. So won't you take the time to call us, 353-9528, or go online at wjct.org. You can, you'll see the big splash page there to support us. Or how else do we do it? Of course, you can text.
You can text, right.
Give 899 to 44321.
Right, 44321. So lots of ways to send your money our way, any amount, and we need it today because this is a very important time that we are trying to raise the funds to keep up the programming that you count on every day. Also, want to remind people, if you do become a sustainer, you get that T-shirt. We got a great T-shirt.
Cool.
I don't know if it's the pictures, but it looks like
actually
it could
a
be
choice of two. You get a
two?
Cool little retro future radio, or you get the microphone, which is kind of cool. So
two choices.
And people will know you're a sustainer and you support quality journalism all across the First Coast, because that's what we deliver every day, 365 days a year, including this program, our flagship news local program, First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross. Excellent program. We love the callers who call in, who sometimes ask questions as good as we can think of.
Right. It's an award-winning program
as well.
Lots of awards. So as a listener, I know how important the news is to me, and we appreciate your loyalty to the station to pledge not only for yourself, but to the community that also relies on the programming that we provide here, whether it be on the radio or television. So call in right now. Don't waste time. We need you at 904-353-9528. If you can't give right now, go home and go to wjct.org and give online that way.
That's exactly right. And we're just a minute and a half away or so going back to First Coast Connect. So you're not going to miss anything. We're just taking a little time here from the round table.
Folks who called in yesterday and today. We heard from Karen in Jacksonville, Frank in Fleming Island, also John in Jacksonville, and Maureen in Interlaken. Kathy listens every day. Kathy's from Jacksonville, and there's another Kathy in St. John's. So thank you to all of you who took the time out to pay attention to your local public radio station. It is listener supported, and if you're a listener, you can gauge about how much you listen every day or every week to whatever your show is, and maybe put a dollar amount on that and give us a call, because it's really important right now.
Well, here we are, 10 seconds away of getting back to Josh here, who's running the board, 353-9528. We thank you so much for your support. Make that call right now.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross addresses issues important to our Northeast Florida communities. Our firm is pleased to support WJCT's First Coast Connect.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Congaree and Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congareeandpenn.com for more information.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in order to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
America's southern states are slammed by a slow-moving disaster.
My fellow Alabamians, Hurricane Sally is not to be taken for granted.
The president takes on a tough town hall and his own CDC director. Plus, the Big Ten says they will play football this fall after all. I'm Jen White. Let's catch up on the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, the Leitner Museum in St. Augustine has a new leader, and he's got big plans for this fall and winter, even in this time of COVID. I learned more from the Leitner's new executive director, David Bagnall. Take a listen.
Hi, David. Good to talk to you, and congrats on the new position.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks so much. Yep, I'm excited to be here.
It's exciting to have you here on the First Coast. You come to the Leitner Museum with a lot of exciting ideas and certainly in an interesting time as museums around the world are dealing with how to put on challenging exhibitions in a pandemic. As you begin this work, what are your thoughts about that and how you'll accomplish that at the Leitner Museum?
You know, it is certainly an unusual time to be taking on this role as executive director at the Leitner Museum. But I mean, I think that, you know, the situation with the pandemic, as much as it, you know, hampers efforts to do events and programming with museums, it does offer a lot of opportunities for exploring new online options. And so I'm particularly interested with the Leitner Museum about making connections with other Gilded Age sites across America. And I think that this situation with the pandemic, museum audiences are looking online for new activities and new programs. So, you know, as difficult as it can be, I think we've got to look at the positives.
Sure. Now, tell us more about the virtual Gilded Age opening this fall at the Leitner. This is interesting in terms of what people looking at it will be able to do. And also, when you look at the historical echoes, people that look at our income inequality today say we're living through another Gilded Age. So there seems to be multiple levels to this.
Right. So, yeah, this fall we are launching a new virtual reality exhibition here at the Leitner Museum. It uses objects from our collection, and it allows our visitors to actually build their own Gilded Age environment. So it's a really exciting exhibit. It's going to be a lot of fun. It kind of puts you in the role of a late 19th, early 20th century decorator. So the individuals that were behind creating some of the very elaborate, opulent interiors of the Gilded Age, you kind of get to play that role. So it's a pretty exciting exhibit for the Leitner Museum.
Sure. Now, you come to St. Augustine from a role at the Dreyhouse Museum in Chicago. That's another restored mansion. And you were involved in restoring that space to glory. So what's it like to come to the Leitner, which is also an architectural masterpiece? And it's just a gorgeous space, the former Alcazar Hotel, as people know. So what's that experience been like for you?
Yeah, so, I mean, the parallels between the two museums was certainly one of the aspects that attracted me to the position at the Leitner Museum. With the Dreyhouse Museum in Chicago, that is housed in the former Samuel Nickerson Mansion, which at the time of its completion was the grandest residence in Chicago. And Nickerson, like Henry Flagler, was a self-made man who rose from very humble beginnings, you know, to become part of the elite of society. And the house that Nickerson commissioned, Flagler's Alcazar Hotel, were just both created at this very dynamic time in American history as the country kind of sort of redefined its cultural identity on its own terms as it approached the new century. You know, the buildings really reflect the sort of aspirations of their owners, you know, these self-made individuals working to shape a modern America. You know, and then in addition to the historic parallels, you know, the museums are conceptually similar. You've got these two Gilded Age buildings that house collections that are not original to the site, but complement the site. So that it offers a lot of opportunity. That sort of dialogue between the building and the collection just offers a lot of opportunity for interpretation. So, you know, it's very early days for me here at the Lightning Museum, and I'm just kind of scratching the surface, but I'm really looking forward to sort of diving into the collection and really getting to grips with, you know, with the building and its collection.
Sure. And you timed this right, speaking as someone who also moved to Florida from Chicago, although a long time before you have. You came down here in the fall. That's the best time to leave Chicago for Florida. So good job, David.
it definitely, you know, I am not going to miss shoveling snow in Chicago.
Right.
In the winter. You know, it is a little warm here in Florida, but
yeah.
You know, I'm sort of adapting to the climate.
That's right. That's right.
Probably the best way to describe it.
Exactly. And there are some days go better than others, but it's a pleasure to speak to you. Welcome to the First Coast. He's David Bagnall, the new executive director of the Leitner Museum in St. Augustine. Thanks, David, so much.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Make sure to tune into the Florida Roundup today at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. In the meantime, make sure to support WJCT. Donate online at WJCT.org or give us a call at 353-9528 and help us meet our goal by 6 o'clock tonight. Thanks.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.